Alan once wrote a book that was never published. Alan, who co-founded the centre, and one of the chapters in the book was called The Biological Machine. And I thought that's such a great title, I'll use it tonight. The Biological Machine. How's is your operating today? It's my biological machine. Your biological machine is operating. Your biological machine is not operating so well at the moment. I'm sure we're all in, to a certain extent, a state of disrepair, if we're all honest. These bodies are very unsatisfactory. They're also magical, but they're very unsatisfactory. I've been contemplating the body a lot recently, especially this afternoon, thinking I had to do a talk this evening. It concentrates the mind. The reason being is that I discovered on YouTube breathing techniques. You can create a lovely sense of well-being through use of your breathing. So essentially what you're doing is you're increasing the amount of oxygen in your blood supply. And so you get this temporary sense of well-being, and it can get very meditative and very trance-like. And so there's lots of different stuff online you can do, and you can do it to whatever. Some people really go for it, and it's quite an intense thing, and other people it's very a soft thing. But, you know, pranayama techniques and all kinds of different circular breathing things. And so I've been experimenting with that because it's, like, fun. Getting high on our own supply, that's what it's called. But anyway, the net outcome is there's a lovely sense of well-being and your bodily lightness. And there's no, as far as I can tell, there's no sort of downside to it. You know, you just get up and carry on and you just feel light and happy. So it's a nice thing to do. But when you get really deeply into it, well, I started to get very aware of the brain, the brain stem, the spine, and the network of the nervous system fanning out and the bloodstream. And it reminded me of a meditation technique called the 32 parts of the body, which I'll explain a little bit later about. It was increasing my awareness of the biological machine. And then, coincidentally, or perhaps not, a friend of mine sent me a link to a short BBC radio programme called Nature Bangs. Weird title. But there was this particular episode called Sea Sponges and the Illusion of Self. Which was really... So I thought, yes, I'll base the talk around that. So essentially what they were saying is that they discovered, marine biologists discovered, that they could take a sea sponge and put it through a filter with a very high density filter, and it would turn the sea sponge into mush. Right? But all the cells would be there, but it would be mush. And then they would leave it, and gradually over time the sea sponge would reform itself. Neat trick. So it was the cells are like a self-organizing system, and they just organize themselves back into a sea sponge. And they were saying, well, how does it do that? And sort of imputing a kind of self-like nature. And they experimented with a red sponge and a blue sponge and put them through the same filter and got this purple gook. And then the extraordinary thing is that the sea sponges reassembled themselves into a red sponge and a blue sponge. So what's doing that then? Is that a self? Is it self doing that? It was a really interesting program. So that got me to thinking. And of course, it is the case that all of life is a self-organizing system. We know this. What I'm about to say now may well offend a few mothers here this evening, because I know there are plenty of you. Did you really make your baby? Did you really make your baby? Honestly? We all know that you made your baby, of course, But did you really? Were you busy at home? And husband comes back and says, after a day's work, and says, oh, love, I'm glad to be back. How's the baby coming on? And you say, well, I'm working on the eyes. I've got two lychees. No. It's a very messy business, bodies, aren't they? Very messy business. Sort of like, love, could you remind me, what's the spleen for again? Detoxifying the blood. Oh, yes, that's right. And it goes here? No, it goes there. Oh, right, okay. What's actually happening? Now, we all know that I don't actually know that much about biology based on the misinformation I gave you about the nature of salmon spawning. However, I do know that there is this process of cell division, isn't there? Isn't this how things come to be? There's this process of cell division. And then the cells divide, and then they divide, and they divide. And it's based on the DNA coding as to how those divisions then multiply and form the various parts of what goes up to make a human being. And all those parts of that human being are made simultaneously. It's not like we'll do the liver, and then we'll do the gallbladder, then we'll do the endocrine system, and then we'll sort of just somehow plonk it all together. It's a self-organising system, isn't it? Now, who does that? Also, I was thinking, well, you've got all these bodily mannerisms, twirlings of the hand. I don't actually know how it is that the hand twirls. You don't actually... Do you know how complicated that is? If you were to actually try to map it out, how unbelievably complicated something as simple as just pushing a button or opening a door actually is. And yet it all happens. And were we to have to sit down and write it all out, my goodness, that would take an awful long time. So we've got this self-organizing system that seems to know exactly what it's doing, which is incredible, but it's also an absolute pain. The body requires constant, especially as you get older, more and more maintenance, less and less fun, more and more maintenance. That seems to be the scheme of things. So we need to feed it, we need to clothe it, we need to keep it away from accidents and sharp objects and terrible things like that. And still the body will go wrong. Poor old Simon, still in the hospital. She did actually say, last time I saw her, to say thank you for all the loving kindness. It does seem to be hitting the mark, so perhaps we could do some more for her. Anyway, there's somebody who knows how unsatisfactory the body is. Bodies age, they get old, they decay, they die. We don't actually have control over them. They're self-organizing and self-destroying entities. They need constant management. They'll always let you down. So why is it that people all over the world insist that it's their self? Mind blowing. You'd think that's the last thing you'd want to associate as being the self. And people know that it's unsatisfactory. It's like there's a booming trade in plastic surgery. You know? And, you know, I go to the dentists, and there's, you know, I could get these broken xylophone fixed up real neat if I wanted to. I don't care. But a lot of people do. They very much care about their appearance because their appearance is a reflection of who they are. Some people are deeply, deeply troubled because they actually believe that they're in the wrong bodies. Well, I believe I'm in the wrong body. I was supposed to be over 6 foot tall, definitely. Olive coloured skin. Definitely a lot more hair on my head. Definitely. Do you know, we could... But actually, when it comes to the Buddha's teaching, we discover that, no, we are actually in exactly the right body, the body that we need in order to learn the lessons, in order to be free. So, even though it's such a pain, it's so unsatisfactory, yet the body is so vaunted in our culture and grasped after as being the self. And in the act of assuming that the body is the self, then all this, the magical side, gets lost. So we overlook the magic of these self-organizing systems. Because all these systems come together to allow what? To allow conscious experiencing. It's quite incredible. But once you have identified the body and consciousness as being self, then you lose all that. And so the whole purpose of the Buddha's teaching is to get us to look and to ask the question, is the body the self? It's not the end of the story by any means, but it's a good place to get started, hey? So yes, so when I entered into monastic training, one of the practices I took up was 32 parts of the body. And so I won't go through all 32 parts of the body, because we could all name 32 parts of the body. That's not difficult. But the first five, for instance, are hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, skin. And so the idea is that you meditatively contemplate those in order, starting with the hair on the head. I mean, there's a formal practice that you can do, but essentially you think about how, because you require nutriment, that nutriment is somehow magically transmuted into the substance that comes out the top of your head. how it does that. I'm looking at all your luscious barnets and with jealousy. Hair of the body? No, got plenty of that. Hair of the head? Less so. So you contemplate how it is that this... So you contemplate the shape, you contemplate its nature, you contemplate on what it depends for it, what it's resting on for its existence. And you do the hair of the head, you can do the hair of the body, you can do nails, teeth, skin, all in the same way. And what you discover through that process is that those things are definitely not me. They're not the self, definitely. The hair... Anytime you go to the barber's, do you leave some of yourself on the floor of the barber's? You don't care about that at all. You don't know what the barber does with it. Shudders to think. What does the barber do with it? And he throws it away, doesn't he? Because he doesn't want it either. It's got no value. You know, we spend all this time... And then the barber takes it all away and he says, nah, that's rubbish. I don't want that. So during the course of this, observing nails, that's a weird one. What are they? They just seem to just protrude out of your fingers, what we're assuming is our fingers. I don't even know what they're made of. Weird substance. And the more you investigate it, the more you look at it, the more obvious it is that all these things are non-self. And it also shows up the unattractiveness of the body. Tremendously. So you have to take a certain amount of care with it. But I moved on from those first five, and then it went to flesh, sinew, bone marrow, blood. And I got to bone. And they say in the texts that there are certain parts of the body that you just become fascinated by. And I got to bones, and I just got really fascinated. And the more I contemplated the skeletal structure, the more I realised that there is actually a skeletal structure there. And I would just be walking about like some, not quite like this, but I would just be very, very aware that there was this skeletal frame, there were all the muscles, there were all the tendons and everything, and you know, there I was sort of walking about like some cosmic robot, which is essentially what we are. And it was truly fascinating. One of the fascinating things I discovered about the skeletal frame is how light it is. It is extraordinarily light. And yet, so how robust. Well, at that time, I was, you know, what, 34 or whatever. It was pretty robust bone. I doubt it's that robust these days. But yeah, so it was fascinating. And what it clearly demonstrated was that in no way, shape or form could the body be the self. And that has a tremendously beneficial effect, because it allows you to allow it to be what it is, rather than being in a constant war with trying to get it to be what you imagine it should be, because it will never be that, because eventually it's all going to turn to dust anyway. Why are we bothering? I don't mean that in a gloomy way, I mean that in a very good way. So it releases you from the attachment to the belief that the body is the self, which means you're far more able to put up with the unpleasant aspects of physical experience. So that in this radio program, they went on to a discussion of, well, what is self? Because everyone has that sense of themselves, don't they? I mean, like, I know I'm not you. The Buddha knew he wasn't Moggallana. He knew he wasn't Ananda. He knew he was him, not someone else. We have that sense of individuality, yeah? That sense of... And they were saying that all their discussions, especially what I'm going to mention next, gave them a sort of identity crisis, which if you contemplate this too much, it will do. But so we all have a sense of ourselves, but where does that reside? That was one of the questions they asked. And one of the people said, well, I really feel like myself is in my head. That's where my sense of self. And think about this. We always talk about sense of self, don't we? We never actually say, no, myself is located there. That's where it is. That's what it's like. That's what it looks like. That's what it is. So that somebody else could say, oh, yeah, I see what you mean. It's always dubious, isn't it? I think my sense of self is this. I think my sense of self is that. It's all very vague. Well, for good reasons. Because there isn't one. But anyway, so we get a sense, and a lot of people will say it's the sense of self is like behind the eyes. I'm looking out. I'm looking out. Do you remember the film... was it Inner Space? Martin Short was inside somebody else's body, sort of having to control everything. So there's a little Martin Short in every one of us, is there? Sort of like driving and steering. However, it's funny, it's interesting, because our sense of self can actually change position. So if someone accuses you of something, you go, me? Me? And you look straight to your heart. You point straight to your heart. So is that where the self's located? Somebody who has a genuine experience of jhana, which is a fixed state of meditation, there is this involution of consciousness, for a better way of putting it, and it appears for all the world as though the seat of consciousness is actually located in your navel, behind your navel. And it appears as though your whole rib cage is this just enormous cathedral-like structure around you. An astonishing thing to experience. So there you go. So now the sense of self is somewhere else. Oh, we never actually think it's in our left elbow, do we? We never go, oh, you've hurt my feelings. Or very seldom. The sense of self is located there. In this radio program, they talked about this philosophical conundrum, which is, you're trapped on Mars, and the only way of getting back is using a teleporter, like Star Trek or whatever. And what can happen, the only way back home is that you get into this teleporter. The teleporter then reads your entire, what you'd call it, your entire being, and is able to change it into data, which can be then messaged back to Earth. So that's the entirety of your physiological and psychological, emotional, so all your memories, everything about you, will be transported back. And there'll be another transporter at the other end, and it will reconstitute you back on Earth. Right? So you know what's going to you know what question's going to be asked now. So is that you? Did you die on Mars? Don't think about this too much, guys. Honestly, I was thinking about it before, and I thought, oh, I'm going to stop thinking about this. Or was some aspect of the self transported back to Earth? And what would that be? So you've had this complete adaptation, nothing remaining on Mars, all the information goes back to Earth, and you are replicated completely and perfectly, well, based on what was on Mars, is replicated. Is that replicant you? What would it have to have in order to be you? So it's got all the senses, so it sees, hears, smells, tastes, touches, got all your memories, all your foibles, all your habits, absolutely everything, right down to the very last degree, is exactly the same. Is that you? Or did you die on Mars? So as far as that replicant is concerned, it's got the sense of self, it's got all the memories, remembers being on Mars, remembers stepping into the teleporter. So as far as the replicant is concerned, that replicant is you, is me, is that it's just a continuation. But is it? So I'll leave you with that mind bomb. Because it's an imponderable. You're never going to get to the bottom of that. But the point was that caused an existential crisis in one of the presenters, which is a bit of a shame. But it only causes an existential crisis based on the belief that there is indeed a self. If there is the total understanding that there is indeed no self, then there is no existential crisis to go through. All existential crises have been gone through. They have been put away forever. The Buddha said that there are four conceits regarding the body. That body is the self, that the self is located in the body, that the body is located in the self, or that the self is the owner of the body. And the whole purpose of practicing insight meditation is to come to discover what is actually taking place, moment by moment. And it's through the practice of insight meditation, so that's looking at all the senses, seeing, hearing, tasting, touching, smelling, all mental experience, the arising of self-view, the arising of that sense of self, whether it appears to be here today and there tomorrow, wherever it is. It arises due to conditions, you see it, you observe it, it arises and it passes away. Perceptions, memories, thoughts, feelings. The whole gamut of our moment-by-moment conscious experience is put under the microscope. Meditative microscope. And we look at each and every component part. What we find... I have to bring it to a close, so it's a very quick description... but what we find through this process of noting, observing, comprehending how transient each and every single component part of any experience of mind and body actually is, how unsatisfactory it is, meaning that it can't be grasped, it can't be clung to, and seeing that it is all arising due to conditions, it is a self-organizing system, It arises due to conditions. Each component part arises, plays its part, passes away, and needs to be repeated with another similar moment, which arises, plays its part, passes away. You come to see that there is this, what we might call an infinitely complex net of conditional relationships going on with all these components. So sound only arises because there's a working ear in that split moment. And because there is a sound, the working ear in that moment, there is the possibility of consciousness arising. So there is a relationship between all those components. So it's like a vast net of relationship. But there is nothing permanent in that net. So there is no permanent net. It's just things just arising and passing away. And what we discover is that it all works perfectly. This moment works perfectly without there being any need for any additional self. That it's not required. Not even going back to this whole thing of, but it feels like I'm here. That is arising due to conditions. That perception, that is a perception, that is arising due to conditions. It's there for a moment, it ceases. It's replaced with another similar moment, which arises, it ceases. And so it's not permanent, it's not graspable, it's not self. So even the sense of self is not self. And that's why it is that the Buddha knows that he's the Buddha and not Moggallana. Because in the process of the construction of each moment, that sense of self is playing a vital role. We'd be lost if we didn't have a sense of individuality. Where would I stop and you begin? Well, that's a mute question. It's a question anyway. The point being, though, that there is nothing out of place. Because what they were concerned with on this radio show was the loss of identity. But you don't lose your identity. You just see through it. You just see that it's all part of this magic fabric of existence, which is necessarily non-dual, which means there isn't a self in opposition to it. There is just it, which is this, which is flowing, dynamic, living conscious experience. With the resolution of that problem, all the problems that are founded in the belief in the self are removed, and what's left is life, flowing dynamically. And with it comes the ability to act, but there's the realization that there is action, but there's no actor. There is consciousness, but there is no conscious witness behind. There's seeing, there's hearing, tasting, touching, smelling, there's thinking, there's considering, there's acting, there's choosing, there's every single component part of what you know life to be is what life is. And all you've done is taken away a wrong idea. And because you take out that wrong idea, you take away the warp that underlies everyone's life and makes people feel separate from life. It gives them that sense of dissatisfaction that there's something wrong and you've got to do something in order to make it right. And all of that's gone. So that you're just left being able to spontaneously live. Someone asked me recently, Paul, do you think the universe is conscious? To which I replied, why did the universe just ask that question? And the person looked at me. You know how when somebody just so completely is lost by what you say that it's almost as if the conversation never happened? It was like that. It was like, oh, how's your dad, by the way? Okay. But that is what is happening. You have this biological machine which allows for consciousness. So Is this biological machine then the avatar for God consciousness?
Guess, if you like.
Where did that come from? Are we cosmic robots?
Yeah, if you like.
But it's... That's the thing with descriptions, you see. I tried to... Someone else I know, I tried to point out that trying to describe... There's a saying in Taoism that, you know, the Tao that can be expressed is not the true Tao. That trying to describe the whole is impossible. It's like four blind men being asked to hold different parts of an elephant and describe what it is that they experience. Of course, all their descriptions are going to be different. The descriptions don't matter. What matters is reaching a point mentally where you give up all the sense in which I have to do something to make the truth happen. That's the whole point of insight meditation. And you're left resting. And because you're left resting, there is a non-conceptual realization of the whole. And that's what sets you free. So what the blind men have to do, holding different... Well, let's say that they're just blindfolded. That makes the analogy work a bit better. What they have to do is stop holding desperately on to the elephant. They have to take a step back and they have to take off their blindfolds, and then they can see the whole. Oh yeah, I see. So yeah, so this biological machine has an ultimate purpose, and the ultimate purpose is to give us the opportunity to come to understand that we are not these separate little individuals bashing into each other. That's the appearance. But actually what we are is the whole. We're not just individual parts, we are the whole. And the only way you can discover what that means is to walk the insight path to its conclusion. And then, quite frankly, it becomes obvious. Or should I say self-evident?